Welcome to the Sales Lunchtime Seminar. And one of the things that we heard during the, well, I say during, continuing to hear during the Brexit day is that we should leave. Because if we leave, we can make our own laws and do our own thing. Subsequent to that, though, there's quite a lot of discussion about whether or not you can make your own laws, whether or not you can do your own thing, whether or not it would be much more effective if we aligned, had a close alignment, close relationship, a common rule book, and other such mechanisms. Here to speak to us about this issue and others is Professor Kenneth Armstrong, who is Professor of EU Law here since 2013.
And it's European law, not EU.
EU, Professor of European law. since 2013, and he is currently on leave on a Leverhulme funded project to explore issues that arise both internally and externally from the Brexit event. He is going to speak for around 20 to 30 minutes, mm-hmm. 20 to 30 minutes, and then we'll open up for discussion. So Kenneth, I give the floor to you.
Thanks very much, Hockey, and thanks very much, everybody, for coming along today to the talk. As Hockey said, this is some work that I've been doing or trying to do in the context of a Leverhulme Trust major research fellowship called The Brexit Effect, looking at issues of convergence and divergence after Brexit. I kind of thought at this stage in the project, so more than 14 months in, I would have an awful lot more to say in terms of what was actually happening. But as of today, we're still fully aligned because the UK is still a member state of the European Union. So it makes it slightly more difficult to do this project than I had planned. So part of what I'm going to talk about today is to think about alignment in a very broad context, including alignment during membership. What did actually, how was alignment during membership secured in legal terms? And therefore, what's going to change as the UK leaves, possibly enters into some kind of transition period, and then thereafter? So some of the more normative questions about whether we should align or not, I might leave to some of the discussion later on. Today, I'm going to focus on a more practical orientation to how has alignment actually worked, and therefore, legally, what has to change as the UK prepares to leave the EU. So really, I want to think about three different kinds of time period. The moment of accession, and then the period of membership, and how UK law was aligned with, complied with, a developing EU regulatory landscape. And I should say that my project focuses specifically on EU regulatory policy, by which I'm looking at issues of market regulation, particularly products, services regulation, rather than the totality of compliance with EU law. The second period to then look at will be the transition period that is established under the withdrawal agreement, and how alignment will work there, and then what happens thereafter, what happens in the future in terms of post-membership. So that's the kind of three time periods. And I want to deal with, I guess, really three dimensions. I'm probably going to deal more with two of those dimensions than the third. The first dimension is the policy context. Well, what's the policy context that surrounds alignment? Why align? What choices have been made during membership, but what choices are being made, particularly about transition and the post-transition period? And specifically, I want to think about instrumental choices. What choices has the UK made in terms of how it has secured its alignment over time? And then the third dimension is the more difficult question about how do you secure democratic oversight and accountability for these choices and the choices to align or diverge. So that's really what the paper, when it develops, will try and do. So I'll try and deal with some of these themes today. So let's think about the policy context, first of all, and the policy context of membership itself. The UK had a position as an EFTA state, as a member of the European Free Trade Association, that it chose to give up and to accede to the then European communities and take on membership. So that was itself a commitment to align. It was a commitment to align with the rules that were already in place in 1973, but more importantly, to then, over time, continue to adopt and implement EU rules. So there was membership of the European Union, and of course we know this more directly from the experience of the accession states, particularly in the 2000s, is that membership is a commitment to align. And in those candidate countries' context, that means before acceding, undertaking a high level of alignment prior to accession. But the point I'm trying to make is accession is itself a commitment to alignment and alignment over time. Therefore, the countries that joined in the 1970s, the UK, Ireland and Denmark, when you think about alignment, at that stage in the development of what was then the European communities, most of the rules were really to do with customs. The customs union had been completed. There were certain rules that had to be adopted by the UK, and the common agricultural policy. The sort of market regulation rules that we think of now were really not in existence, or only beginning to develop through the 1970s. And I'll say a little bit more about that later. So the point is, at this stage of alignment, there was less of the kind of market regulation material to align with. And if you think of those of you who are studying European Union law, and particularly free movement law, the classic cases of Dassonville and Cassis on the free movement of goods all presupposed that there was no harmonisation, there was no EU rules in place. Regulatory policy does, however, begin to emerge in the 1970s. It emerges in a number of different areas, largely focused on goods, but including some of the environmental aspects. The kind of waste directives appear in the 1970s onwards. But there's a real step change takes place through the 1980s with the internal market programme and the drive to complete the single market. So this idea of a single market rule book, in different sorts of areas, only really begins to take off the ground once the UK has joined in the 1980s. And of course, from a policy point of view, the UK was fully behind that, fully behind the idea of creating an internal market, and that included EU rulemaking. One thing that we see, though, that changes during the UK's membership is that much of this regulatory activity, the rulemaking activity, is in the form of directives. And directives require transposition and implementation. So that's going to require some degree of domestic activity that's going to secure continuing conformity and alignment over time. But one thing that changes is that as these legal frameworks that have been put in place through the 70s and 80s and 90s mature, the EU starts to recast them into regulations that are directly applicable. And therefore, they no longer are so dependent upon domestic instruments transposing them. So this shift from directives to regulations then has to entail some sort of corresponding recognition or shift domestically, and I'll talk a little bit about that. What other things happen in the policy context during membership? The legal basis for much of the EU's legislative activity in the 70s onwards in this area was Article 100 of the European Economic Community Treaty. And it deals with the approximation of national laws, or the rapprochement of national laws. Therefore, it assumes that there are national laws that need to be harmonised and aligned to create a common rule for the member states. But as we move through into more modern times, the EU is simply regulating on stuff that the member states haven't necessarily regulated on or only beginning to think about regulating. New markets are being created as new technologies develop. So we have mobile phone telephony, data roaming, etc., all coming in as new EU legal frameworks, less to do with the approximation of pre-existing national rules. So by the time the EU referendum comes around in the UK in 2016, we have a very developed EU regulatory apparatus that is both deep and broad. It's broad because it is no longer just located in the realm of goods, but includes services and, crucially, financial services. But it's also deep. It involves significant levels of not just EU legislative activity, but its non-legislative activity through delegated and implementing rules. So that's the kind of context of the changing nature of EU regulatory policy. What then about the policy context of Brexit itself? Well, as Oki suggested at the beginning, it's quite value-laden, this policy context. We know some of the mantras around it, including taking back control. And taking back control has many manifestations, but one of which is taking back control over laws and trade. That means, or has been translated into, an idea that the UK must leave not just the EU, but also its single market and its customs union. That the only true Brexit, if you like, is one that is outside of these frameworks. There are three caveats, however, to that. Different policy choices are being made. One is that the entirety of the EU's legal framework will be domesticated. It will be brought into UK law to ensure perfect alignment at the moment that the UK exits or at the end of the transition period, whichever is later. Secondly, that there is a policy choice to have a transition period agreed between the EU and the UK to allow for a period between exit and the UK's new future relationship with the EU, during which time the UK will continue to align with the EU, not just in terms of those rules that were in place, but actually any new rules coming into force during transition. And the third caveat that is important, and particularly in respect of this question about alignment, is the avoidance of a hard border on the island of Ireland and the implications of that in terms of enduring regulatory alignment to avoid regulatory checks. There are other policy choices that are being made here that I think are also worth highlighting. One is the repeal of the European Communities Act 1972. The European Communities Act 1972 has been the cornerstone of the UK's legal framework for giving effect to its membership. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. And therefore you may think, well, the repeal of that act is just the obvious thing you do when you're going to then leave the European Union. But the timing of that, of when you repeal the European Communities Act, is a political choice, and it has significant ramifications in terms of how you put in place a legal framework for the transition period. I'll explain that in more detail. The final big policy context choice, is once you take the UK out of the single market and the customs union, to give the UK maximum autonomy, that is also then related to the UK's ambitions to pursue future trade policy agreements. And in various letters that Boris Johnson has written, he has made clear that there is quite a clear connection between the UK's desire to get out of the customs union, to have control over its trade policy, and regulatory policy, the autonomy to pick and choose whether to continue to align or diverge from the European Union. And that is, of course, where we then get into some interesting political territory as to what that then entails and why the UK might diverge. So that's the policy context. I want to spend some more time, because you're all lawyers, or mainly lawyers, thinking about the instrumental level. And some of this is, I guess, familiar, although as many of you are from other countries, not necessarily from the UK, maybe less familiar is how the UK has actually legally secured its membership and therefore what will change when the UK leaves. So I mentioned a moment ago that the European Communities Act 1972 is really the cornerstone of the UK's legislative framework. It gave effect to the UK, to the accession treaty that applied to the UK, Denmark and Ireland. It also gave effect to the European Communities treaties that were then in existence, and also facilitates the addition of any new treaties via statutory amendment to the European Communities Act. So every time we had the Single European Act, the Amsterdam Treaty, Nice Treaty, Lisbon, etc., they were all simply added as treaties to which the European Communities Act gave effect. The more significant provisions for our purposes are Sections 2.1 and 2.2. Section 2.1 gives effect to directly applicable EU rules, including regulations. That gives it a particular quality, an ambulatory quality. That is to say that as and when the EU adopts regulations that are directly applicable, they simply automatically have application in the UK. Section 2.1 recognises them as having immediate legal effect. And therefore, as these rules change over time, the UK simply maintains alignment through this ambulatory quality. Section 2.2, however, gives a different power, and that is the power to, via domestic regulation, via statutory instruments, to incorporate EU obligations into national law. And that particularly applies to directives which require transposition into domestic law. So, thinking back to what I said at the outset about how things had changed during membership, the Article 2.1 ambulatory quality actually wasn't particularly of much application to market regulation, because there was very little of it, and what came in through the 70s and 80s was through directives. And therefore, this ambulatory quality of alignment was really much more directly related to changes in any of the EU customs rules, and particularly the common agricultural policy, which is largely done via regulations. The other thing to say, though, is that although the European Communities Act is, if you like, the cornerstone, the constitutional cornerstone of alignment, other pieces of primary legislation in the UK could be used to transpose directives into domestic law. The European Communities Act itself amended the Food and Drugs Act of 1955 to include within it a provision very similar to Article 2.2 to allow ministers to adopt delegated rules to implement EU food rules. The Consumer Protection Act 1987, used to implement the Toy Safety Directive, for example. And the Health and Safety at Work Act of 1974, used to implement EU pesticides, the biocides directive, as it then was. So the landscape, mechanisms for alignment, dominated by the European Communities Act, but includes these other pieces of legislation. So if you think about what's going to happen next, when we repeal the European Communities Act, we're going to have to think about, does something replace it to give effect to something during transition? But these other pieces of legislation still may still exist, and therefore may only need amendment in some shape or form, may not need to be entirely replaced or recast. So, over time during membership then, Section 2.2 of the European Communities Act increased in significance as the body of market regulation directives came on stream and developed. This Section 2.1, ambulatory quality, as I said, was really only significant at the beginning for the Common Agricultural Policy, but it becomes much, much more engaged as the EU's legal framework matures and these market regulation directives are flipped into being regulations. Suddenly, you no longer need a domestic instrument for alignment. You have a regulation which is directly applicable and given effect via Section 2.1. The other thing that changed during membership was to recognise that once you implemented directives via statutory instruments, the painful thing about these directives is they were continually being amended to take into account technical scientific progress, changes. Suddenly we find that the particular concentration of chromium 4 in a paint is more toxic than we thought. So then we change the rules on that at EU level. Well, hang on, that means changing the domestic statutory instrument again. What was introduced by the Legislative and Regulatory Reform Act 2006 was the capacity for the statutory instruments, the domestic rule, to have an ambulatory quality. So you get, for example, toy safety regulations in the UK implementing the Toy Safety Directive. You may have annexes to that directive, which then tell you certain things about health and safety, limits of lead in paint, etc., which are constantly being changed. The Toy Safety Regulations have a provision which means that anything that it refers to as a schedule to the regulation has the same meaning as an annex to the directive. So therefore it just updates over time. As the annexes are changed at EU level, the regulation is automatically securing alignment through the directive, through the domestic regulation. So the system is getting cleverer at recognising that these kind of ambulatory qualities are quite handy to keep the rules perfectly aligned over time. The one final thing to say is that it will be obvious that the amount of activity of creation of these statutory instruments is now going to increase over time through the initial decades of membership, through the 80s and 90s, to secure continuing alignment. And I hope I have a kind of graph here which shows that. It's not a very good graph. I mean, it looks quite pretty, but it's not a very good graph in many ways. What it highlights, I think, though, is, and these are just taking five-year time periods, these are the total number of statutory instruments that reference the European Communities Act as either the direct legal basis of the instrument, or it sets out the purpose which a different piece of primary legislation is giving effect. And these are utterly indistinguishable. They don't say what these statutory instruments are for. These are just total numbers. I haven't yet managed to find the time to drill down. But in the first decade of membership, you have in total 125 four domestic statutory instruments, many of which are dealing with things completely other than market regulation. But look what happens once you get into the 80s and the internal market program gets up and running. Suddenly, a big spike. We've got 313 over a five-year period. In the next five-year period, that more than doubles to 790 statutory instruments being incorporated at domestic level. Again, these are not wholly related to the internal market, but many of them are. By the time we then get into the 90s, the late 1990s, and I don't have good stats on this because the return for any given year just says over 200. In any given year, in that period, we're having more than 200 instruments. So in a five-year period, over 1,000 instruments each year being adopted. So the total number of SIs adopted in every year between 1999 and 2011 exceeded 200 in each year. So it's a vast amount of activity to secure UK compliance in alignment with EU rules. So what's going to happen then when the UK leaves? So the legal tasks that the UK is facing are, I think, primarily four in number. The first thing it has to do will be to give legislative effect to the withdrawal agreement, including its provisions on transition, which ensure that the UK will continue to align until it finally exits the transition period. The second task is, because of the specific protocol on Ireland and Northern Ireland, which aims to ensure that in terms of manufactured goods and certain agricultural goods, the rules will be the same to avoid border checks, we need to give effect to that in domestic law. We also need to do the thing that is the policy choice, which is at the moment that the UK leaves, or at the end of the transition period, whichever is later, there will be this perfect alignment of domestic rules with EU law at that moment. And then the fourth task is repealing the European Communities Act itself. And in very broad terms, we have two pieces of legislation, one of which has been adopted and one of which has been proposed but is now in limbo pending the general election. So the first piece of legislation is the European Union Withdrawal Act 2018. The first non-piece of legislation, the bill that is the European Union Withdrawal Agreement Bill, the WAB, which was proposed in October, deals with legal tasks 1 and 2. And the European Union Withdrawal Act, which was passed in 2018, is going to deal with tasks 3 and 4, the alignment and repeal. Now, this is not a very happy situation. The repeal of the 2018 Act, the repeal of the European Communities Act, 1972, by the 2018 Act complicates things. It would have been perfectly possible for the UK not to have repealed the 1972 Act and just kept it running during the transition period. Sections 2.1, sections 2.2 would apply. Directly applicable rules continue to apply. Anything else that required transposition, section 2.2. Everything would have stayed the same. That isn't going to happen. It has been repealed. And therefore what... Yeah?
On what date is it repealed?
Well, the commencement order finally... specified that it would be repealed as of exit day. So it will be repealed.
But exit day is... What makes exit day the start of the transition period rather than the end of the transition period?
Because the WAB identifies a different endpoint called the IP completion date or something, the implementation completion date, which is when transition ends. So we have, we still have exit date when we leave, and this new date, IP completion date, which is when the transposition period, the transition period ends, and then we get the new future. So a political choice has been made that we have to leave, and the European Communities Act has to be repealed. The effect of that is that the Withdrawal Agreement Bill, which still wants to give effect to EU law in the UK during the transition period, and in the same way as it was given effect during membership, a condition in Article 4 of the Withdrawal Agreement, means that it has to summon up the spirit of the European Communities Act, to resurrect it or reincarnate it in some form by saving its effect. So Section 1A is introduced into the 2018 Act to do that. For the purposes of Part 4 of the Withdrawal Agreement, that is the transition period. The WAB also introduces a new Section 1B into the 2018 Act, which is to preserve the effect of Section 2.2 of the European Communities Act. So let's think about this. First thing, 1A, is preserving the ambulatory quality of alignment contained in Section 2.1 of the European Communities Act. That effect will be saved. Directly applicable rules will still have application during the transition period, alignment secured. I don't have a problem with that. I think it's slightly odd that you just haven't kept it formally in force, but you're just saving its effect. That's not so difficult. Where things get difficult is with the idea that you can save the effect of Section 2.2. Section 2.2 is a rulemaking power. So you've repealed the instrument that creates the rulemaking power, but somehow you save its effect as a rulemaking power that you can continue to use UK statutory instruments that reference Section 2.2 of the European Communities Act to transpose any new legislation that comes into force during the transition period. I do struggle with the idea that other legal systems would accept the idea that your parent act is repealed, but somehow another piece of legislation saves its effect as a rulemaking power. That strikes me as really quite odd, and it's odd because of this policy choice, this policy commitment to repeal the European Communities Act. So, in a way, the European Communities Act is dead, but it's resurrected. The ghost of the European Communities Act haunts the Withdrawal Agreement bill to continue to allow for UK law to align with EU law during transition. What happens then after transition? This is particularly important for what happens in Northern Ireland. So Northern Ireland will be in the same position as the rest of the UK through the transition period. All the same rules will continue to apply to all of the UK. But once the UK finally exit transition, or if there is no transition, this alignment that is desired for Northern Ireland has to have be given some form of legal effect. The Withdrawal Agreement Bill introduces a new Section 7A into the 2018 Act to reincarnate the wording of Section 2.1 of the European Communities Act when applied to the protocol, again, so that the ambulatory effects of EU law can, in some way, the ambulatory effect can continue to ensure the application of directly applicable EU law in Northern Ireland. The WAB also introduced a new Section 8C into the 2018 Act to give ministers powers to make statutory instruments to implement the protocol. So we'll have another new rulemaking power to use statutory instruments to align the rules in Northern Ireland. Note what's going on here, that this withdrawal agreement bill is continually having to amend the act that was enacted last year. It's a very odd and complex legal environment that you have to continually read between the two pieces of legislation to see where you end up. And in many ways, they're the wrong way round. The withdrawal agreement bill would better have been enacted first and not repealed the European Communities Act, then to be followed by the European Union Withdrawal Act that doesn't say anything about the European Communities Act at all. So it's a very difficult and slippery legal environment to work between. For the rest of the UK, alignment is secured at the moment that the UK leaves and transition ends under the 2018 Act. This entire body of EU law acts as retained EU law as of that date, but as a purely domestic body of law. What happens thereafter, of course, things could then change. The Section 19 of the 2018 Act says that nothing in this Act shall prevent the United Kingdom from replicating in domestic law any EU law made on or after exit day. That's a slightly odd provision because it's not saying you shall enact rules to give effect to any new rules. It's just saying nothing this Act prevents you from doing it.
Presumably, it doesn't create a power.
So it doesn't have to find
the power in some other piece of legislation.
Exactly. So there's going to have to be something else there. All it's doing is signalling that there's nothing in the Act prevents you from enacting a rule that replicates an EU rule. But if you want to do that, Bill says you're going to have to find some other legal power and legal basis on which to do that, which is itself an interesting question. But with all this body of rules being domesticated, they don't necessarily work in the way that they should do because they presupposed EU membership. And therefore, there's the Section 8 deficiency power in the 2018 Act, which allows these to be amended. But in a sense, when we talk about it being a deficiency, the deficiency is that they no longer make sense in the context of not being a member state. And if it's a very wide power to amend those regulations. And therefore, hundreds of statutory instruments are being created to domesticate and amend and change the domestic rules to make them work. And in some cases, and this answers your point, those regulations are being changed to include the power in the statutory instrument to then amend the rules as they may then change over time. So the power is then subsumed somewhere, usually deep within the regulations, because they view it as a deficiency that something which would have changed at an EU level now requires something to be done domestically. And therefore the power is there for the minister, for example, to change the schedule to a regulation to add in chromium 4 as a new list of prohibited substances. So the rulemaking power is delegated right down. Okay, I'm running out of time, I realise. So I think one of the key things I'd note then is that kind of ambulatory quality where rules would automatically adjust and align is now being replaced with ministerial discretion. Ministers are empowered to enact rules. They are the ones who are going to be choosing whether to continue to follow EU rules or not follow them. And this is often on very technical stuff, but often stuff that you actually really care about, which is what if the EU decides to ban a pesticide because they believe that it harms bees, but a UK minister decides, actually, farmers really quite like using that pesticide and we're not really that bothered about the bees. Will we or will we not change the regulation? And it's hidden in delegated rulemaking. Which leads me to my final slide, which is about oversight. So taking back control isn't just about having technical control over laws in the way in which I've been describing. It is also about having democratic accountability for rulemaking. Now, one of the critiques of the EU as a form of regulatory state is that the regulatory state outsources this question of democracy and replaces it with some form of bureaucratic, technocratic expertise. We simply rely upon scientific evidence, we rely upon expertise, we rely upon independent institutions to make those decisions about pesticides, chromium levels, etc. But of course, that is part of the complaint about EU membership, is that these kind of democratic choices seem to have been replaced with something else. And therefore, that, if that's one of the causes of Brexit, we might then think that the answer then isn't just to replicate the regulatory state, but somehow to radically change it, to do something different, to take back control and do something different. But I think what we can see emerging isn't that. It is about the reproduction of the regulatory state and renationalizing it, giving it a domestic legal form. And in many ways, many of our anxieties about oversight are enhanced because of the way in which much of the rulemaking is going to be done through the exercise of ministerial power. And then the question is what oversight there is. Now, one of the interesting things that the WAB introduces is a provision which empowers the European Scrutiny Committee of the House of Commons to monitor new EU rules during the transition period and to raise any concerns of vital national interest. And this seems like an interesting kind of democratic oversight, monitoring what is the evil EU up to during the transition period, what rules are they enacting that the UK is going to have to follow. But in some ways it misses the point, and it's always been the point, that an entity like the European Scrutiny Committee has always struggled to monitor delegated rulemaking at EU level, which is where most of the activity is now taking place. That's no answer then to what's going to happen with all this enhanced delegated rulemaking domestically and what sort of scrutiny there'll be of that. Thank you very much.